content of this program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first, of December 15th, The Church and the Mafia. The Italian Church is dissolving its links to the mob. The mutual tolerance of the 1970s and 1980s is at an end. To all appearances, this was a final disentangling of the disreputable connections between the church in southern Italy and organized crime. When a Sicilian mobster known as the Boss of Bosses died in prison last month, a spokesman for the Italian Conference of Bishops said it would be, quote, unthinkable to give him a public funeral. Ultimately, said the spokesman, Salvatore Toto Riina would be judged by God. But the church had a clear duty to set a proper public example, and colluding with lavish obsequies for this multiple killer would have amounted to the very opposite. In the end, Riina was given a private funeral in his home village of Corleone, which gave its name to the central family of The Godfather, a classic novel and film. A local priest gave a blessing. So, is this a final rupture? Is it true that the hierarchs of the Church, including Pope Francis, have made a serious effort to disengage their institution from Italy's notorious organized crime syndicates, Cosa Nostra in Sicily, the 'Ndrangheta in the Calabria region, and the Camorra in Naples? In 2014, the Pope went to a town in Calabria where a 3-year-old boy had been killed along with his grandfather, in a case apparently linked with drugs, and declared that he was excommunicating the mafia. He also attended a service in Rome where the names of over 800 people killed by mafia groups were read out. The pontiff declared that the mobsters would end up in hell unless they repented. All this seems a long way from the world of the 70s and 80s, when mafia power was almost uncontrolled, and there was a strange pact of mutual tolerance that was regarded in certain quarters as a necessary price for keeping Italy in the Western anti-Soviet camp during the Cold War. Italy's Catholic-inspired Christian Democratic Party, the Catholic Church, and organized crime had the common purpose of keeping communism at bay, and they seemed to avoid picking fights with one another. During this period, says Isai Sales, a historian from Naples, the church was much too quick to offer Christian forgiveness to perpetrators of violence who showed no sign of contrition. Quote, in certain cases in Sicily, the clergy were either silent on violence or openly praised the bosses. They offered spiritual services to people on the run by marrying them and baptizing their children. Even today, to anyone visiting Sicily, it feels as though the disentangling of the church and the mob, while impressive enough, is a recent, precarious, and perhaps not entirely complete process. In March, the Bishop of Monreale in Palermo province decreed that members of the mafia could not act as godfathers in the literal sense. In other words, they could not be spiritual protectors of children designated at their baptism. Such decrees would not be issued if they were unnecessary. A couple of months later, there was an outcry after a religious procession in Corleone seemed to make a gesture of homage to the Riina family, though organizers denied this. Gianni De Gennaro, a Jesuit priest from Naples who moved to Sicily, says things have changed a lot for the better over the past 30 years. Quote, when I arrived, I wasn't even allowed to say the word mafia out loud, he recalls. Now he offers welfare services to vulnerable locals and migrants, including victims of mafia abuses, on land that was confiscated from the mob. In his view, the shift in the church's stance owes a lot to the self-sacrifice of a number of brave individual priests who spoke out against the mob when it was still highly dangerous to do so, and were killed as a result. One such cleric was Pino Pigliucci, slain in Palermo on his 56th birthday in 1993 after challenging the mafia's hold over his rough neighborhood. He fought hard to weaken the mob's control over children. Some of these pioneering clerical foes of the mafia survived to tell the tale and are pleased that the church as a whole has changed its position. An example is Giacomo Ribaudo, who wrote an open letter of denunciation to Riina long before bishops were active in that cause. He now says, quote, the church woke up late to this fight, but what's important is that it eventually took a side. With Riina's death, the peak of the Cosa Nostra has passed, but that doesn't mean the Mafia has been eradicated. Acts of fierce public violence have decreased, but we should not let down our guard. As for the feelings of ordinary faithful Catholics in Sicily, the statue in the town hall of Zafferana, a small conservative village on the slopes of Mount Etna, may provide a clue. As locals explain, it is a likeness of Archbishop Salvatore Pappalardo, who, as Archbishop of Palermo in the 1970s, was one of the few senior clerics to admit the existence of the Mafia and to denounce it. Villagers are proud of the fact that this brave prelate spent his summers and retirement years enjoying the cool weather and winding streets of their little hamlet. It is a part of the world where gestures, symbols, and images speak louder than words. And now from the Associated Press of December 16th. Vatican has issued new rules for relics in saint-making process. The Vatican's saint-making office has updated its rules governing the use of relics for would-be saints, issuing detailed new guidelines Saturday that govern how body parts and cremated remains are to be obtained, transferred, and protected for eventual veneration. The instructions explicitly rule out selling the hair strands, teeth, hands, and other body parts of saints that often fetch high prices in online auctions. They also prohibit the use of relics in sacrilegious rituals and warn that the Church may have to obtain consent from surviving family members before unearthing the remains of candidates for sainthood. Bodily relics are an important part of Catholic tradition, since the body is considered to be the instrument of the person's saintliness. Beatification and canonization masses often feature the relic being ceremoniously brought to the altar in an elaborate display case, and allowing the faithful to publicly venerate the new blessed or saint for the first time. Officials said the new guidelines were necessary given some obstacles that had arisen since the rules were last revised in 2007, particularly when surviving relatives and church officials disagreed. One current case before a U.S. appeals court concerns a battle over the remains of Fulton Sheen, an American archbishop known for his revolutionary radio and television preaching in the 1950s and 60s. Sheen's niece went to court to force the Archdiocese of New York to transfer Sheen's body from the crypt of St. Patrick's Cathedral to Peoria, Illinois, where Sheen was born, ordained a priest, and where his sainthood cause has been launched by Peoria's bishop. The New York Archdiocese refused and appealed a 2016 lower court ruling in favor of the niece. A decision from the appeals court is expected soon. Monsignor Robert Sarno of the Vatican's Congregation for the Causes of Saints says it's impossible to know what difficulties could complicate a saint-making case or whether the new guidelines might have helped avoid the legal battle over Sheen. But Sarno said the Vatican believed the updates were needed anyway to provide bishops around the world with a detailed go-to guide in multiple languages to replace the Latin instructions that provided only general rules to follow. New to the protocols is an article that makes it clear that bishops must have, quote, consent of the heirs in place where the bodies of the dead legally belong to surviving family members or heirs. The revised instructions lay out in detail how a body is to be unearthed, saying it must be covered with a, quote, decorous cloth while a relic is being taken or authenticated and then reburied in clothes of similar style. They also make clear that the bishops involved must agree in writing to any transfer of remains and call for absolute secrecy when a body is unearthed and a relic taken for eventual veneration. The document repeats church teachings that relics from candidates for sainthood can only be venerated publicly once they have been beatified, the first possible step to sainthood, and not before. The guidance explicitly allows for cremated remains to be used as relics. For most of its 2,000-year history, the Catholic Church only permitted burial, arguing it is best expressed the Christian hope for resurrection. But in 1963, the Vatican explicitly allowed cremation as long as it didn't suggest a denial of faith about resurrection. The new instructions also only cover the so-called first class of relics from the actual body of the saintly candidate. The Church also recognizes second- and third-class relics, such as clothes or other materials that came into contact with the would-be saint's body. And now from the Religion News Services. How Christmas is linked to Hanukkah. Hanukkah, which began Tuesday, December 12th, has been incorrectly called the Jewish Christmas because both holidays emphasize light and take place during the darkest days of winter. While the two festivals are very different in message and observance, they are, however, some significant links between Hanukkah and Christmas. The New Testament records that Jesus, like other Jews of his time, celebrated the 8 days of Hanukkah. It was the feast of the dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon, says John 10:22-23. The Hebrew word Hanukkah means dedication. If Charles Dickens had written about Hanukkah in a manner similar to his A Christmas Carol, the famous English author would have noted that special prayers are recited in Jewish homes each night of the holiday as young and not so young children light colorful candles in a candelabrum or menorah. Dickens would surely have described in loving detail the unmistakable aroma and taste of the two traditional holiday treats, potato pancakes fried in oil and loaded with calories and cholesterol, along with small jelly donuts that rapidly rise a person's blood sugar level. Gifts are exchanged among family members and friends, and a series of well-known songs are sung that are especially beloved by adults, including me, because they evoke warm, joyous childhood memories of Hanukkah's long past. That's how the holiday is celebrated today. But the warm and fuzzy aspects of the festival frequently obscure the darker historical side of Hanukkah. The holiday commemorates the military struggle in the land of Israel between 168 and 165 BC, when Judah Maccabee's small number of Jewish guerrillas defeated a much larger and better armed Greco-Syrian army of Emperor Antiochus IV, a brutal ruler who reigned over part of Alexander the Great's former empire. Antiochus was no champion of religious liberty and diversity. In his zeal for total control over his vast realm, he prohibited the study of Torah, ritual circumcision, and kosher dietary laws, Sabbath observance, and the practice of Judaism itself. An ancient historian detailed Antiochus' cruelty. Quote, "The books of the Torah, which the men of Antiochus found, they tore into pieces and burned. Wherever a book of the covenant was found in anyone's possession, or if anyone respected the Torah, the decree of the king imposed the sentence of death upon him. Month after month they dealt brutally with every Jew who was found in the cities. In accordance with the decree, they put to death the women who had circumcised their children, hanging the newborn babies around their necks, and they also put to death their families as well as those who had circumcised them. When Judah's forces recaptured Jerusalem, they demolished the statues of Zeus and other idolatrous symbols Antiochus had placed inside the holy temple and rededicated the temple to the service of God. Judah's victory of the few over the many has earned him his own statue at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where he stands alongside other great military leaders. Jewish tradition teaches that the small quantity of olive oil that Judah found was insufficient to fuel the temple's eternal light beyond one day, but somehow the precious oil lasted 8 days, an event described as the miracle of Hanukkah. Many historians agree that Hanukkah represents an early struggle for what we call today religious liberty or freedom of conscience. The holiday is an annual reminder that every faith community has the right to maintain its diverse customs, ceremonies, and teachings, and no ruler, government, or regime has the right to dictate what people can and cannot believe. Hanukkah's message remains as relevant as it was more than 2,100 years ago. Today, there are forced religious conversions involving kidnapped young children, beheadings based on one religion's identity, and numerous bloody religious wars raging in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and other parts of the world. And finally, without the Maccabees' victory and the preservation of Jewish religious life in ancient Israel, Christianity may not have emerged 200 years later, with its taproots deeply embedded within Judaism. The only scripture Jesus knew, of course, was the Torah, the malevolent Antiochus wanted to obliterate. The Jewish Holy Temple in Jerusalem, mentioned in the New Testament, was saved from desecration and rededicated to God 150 years before Jesus was born. As Jews and Christians celebrate the distinctive festivals of light and faith, it is altogether fitting and proper that both communities remember Judah Maccabee's long-ago victory over the forces of darkness, despotism, and death. And from the Associated Press now of December 16th, an effort to allow partisan politics in church has reached a dead end. A provision that would have freed churches to make political endorsements has been dropped from the Republican tax overhaul, dashing the hopes of a segment of religious conservatives on what has been a key issue of the Trump administration. Advocacy groups on opposing sides said Friday they expect lawmakers to keep trying to loosen rules over partisanship in the pulpit, even as this latest effort has reached a dead end. Conservative groups such as the Family Research Council and the Alliance Defending Freedom have for years sought to abolish IRS rules that bar electioneering by houses of worship and other charitable groups. President Donald Trump pressed the fight on the campaign trail and in the White House. Still, only Congress has the authority to repeal the restriction known as the Johnson Amendment. It was named for President Lyndon Johnson, who introduced the measure in 1954 when he was a Democratic senator from Texas, upset about a few nonprofit groups that had attacked him as a communist during the Senate race. Under the IRS regulations, churches and other nonprofits can engage in a wide range of activity related to public issues, such as advocating for certain policies. However, pastors and churches are not allowed to endorse a particular candidate in a sermon or during church services without potentially losing their status as an organization exempted by the government from paying taxes. Even so, the IRS rarely enforces the rule. The latest repeal effort was tucked into the GOP tax bill. The House eliminated the restrictions for houses of worship and all nonprofits. The Senate bill did not include the provision, prompting a negotiation as a House-Senate committee worked to blend the two separate tax bills into a final package. The Senate parliamentarian decided the provision did not meet a Senate requirement that all parts of the bill be related to the budget. Many religious groups, including some Christian conservatives, want to keep the IRS restriction as it is. They included the American Baptist Churches USA, the Union for Reformed Judaism, the Episcopal Church, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which counts Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson as a prominent member. The groups say repealing the revision could divide their congregations along political lines and fear potential pressure from congregants to endorse politicians. Quote, they seemed most concerned about what this would do to their houses of worship and their communities that they value so much, said Amanda Tyler, executive director of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. They talked about how politically and ideologically diverse their church families are, and how this could really tear at the heart of the community and both distract and divert them from the reason they come together as a church. A February survey by the National Association of Evangelicals, which represents 40 denominations and thousands of churches, found 89% of evangelical leaders said pastors should not endorse politicians from the pulpit. But Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, said opponents want to keep religious leaders in churches remain muzzled, or at least intimidated into silence, and vowed to keep fighting, quote, until we have legislatively corrected this injustice or found a remedy in court. Eric Stanley, senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom, said, quote, this is one of the president's campaign promises. We're hopeful he'll continue to do the right thing by continuing to fix the Johnson Amendment. Trump had promised to, quote, totally destroy the Johnson Amendment. Still, Stanley said, ultimately, this issue resides with Congress. The repeal has little public support. A survey of registered voters this past fall by the Program for Public Consultation at the University of Maryland found overwhelming majorities of Democrats and Independents and a large majority of Republicans opposed easing the restriction. Campaign finance groups warned the change could have far-reaching implications, turning churches into tools for secret campaign spending. Despite the tax bill's failure, Tyler is watching for language on the IRS rules to be inserted into other legislation, such as end-of-year budget measures. A standalone bill would need 60 votes to pass the Senate, requiring support from Democrats, which is unlikely. Senator James Lankford, an Oklahoma Republican who pushed to abolish the restriction, said the current rules keep tax-exempt organizations in, quote, constant fear that they may have crossed a line. Still, Republican John Faso, a New York Republican, said he was happy the prohibition was preserved. Endorsement of candidates isn't why most people go to religious services, Vassa wrote on Twitter. Back to the Economist now of December 11th. Islam, marriage, and the law. How best to help women caught between different kinds of family law? No easy answer to the conundrums posed by religious marital laws. As is reported by The Economist in this week's print edition, almost everybody can agree that there are acute difficulties at the interface between Islamic family law and the liberal West, especially for married Muslim women living in a kind of limbo between the Islamic world and the secular world can be exceptionally tough. So far, so much consensus. What people don't agree on, however, is how to improve the situation. Start with England, which presents an extreme case for the pathologies facing Muslim minorities in the West. In no other country have so many Sharia councils sprung up to adjudicate the affairs of Muslim people, especially women who are trapped in unhappy marriages and want a religious divorce. Some say these councils should be regulated, others want them abolished. In no other country is it so common for young Muslim couples to have religious-only marriages or nikahs, which are never registered with the state, so that in the event of a breakdown, the financially vulnerable partner, usually female, has few entitlements. Ayina Khan, a London-based lawyer who specializes in family law, is a prime mover of a campaign called Register Our Marriage, which aspires both to change the law and to make Muslims, especially women, more conscious of the dire consequences of a religion-only rite. The campaign wants to close the gap between faith-based and civil wedding ceremonies by making it easy, virtually automatic, and indeed compulsory for religious nuptials to be registered in the eyes of the state. In other words, all faiths would require the status and the corresponding obligations long enjoyed by the Anglicans, Jews, and Quakers. As the website puts it, this petition is to reform outdated English marriage law, which is no longer fit for purpose. We need to reform the Marriage Act of 1949, as it is 70 years old, out of date. Make it compulsory for every faith to register marriages, not just three faiths. Hundreds of thousands of people have no legal rights in an unregistered religious marriage, and this figure is rising yearly. A different view is taken by Sadukur Rahman, a London solicitor who is also a supporter of the National Secular Society. He agrees that there is an anomaly in treating Anglicans, Jews, and Quakers differently from other faiths, but he wrote in a recent article that, according to civil status, all Muslim marriages would be, quote, highly problematic for several reasons. As he argues, the question of what is a Muslim marriage is a vexed one. Muslim marriage encompasses a range of unions which would not be acceptable on the basis that they may be discriminatory or open to abuse. For example, polygamous marriages, temporary marriages amongst Shia Muslims and nowadays young Muslims of all sects, and marriages between adults and children. On the other hand, Mr. Rahman adds, if we start debating what is and is not a Muslim marriage and go down the route of siding with Islamic reformers in not accepting the above types as Muslim marriages at all, then the state would be entering into a religious theological debate, which is in no position for a secular state to be in. It is not for the state to start defining what is and is not a Muslim marriage. The best approach, in Mr. Rahman's view, is for the state to be blind to all forms of marriage except the civil sort. That would involve stripping the Anglican, Jewish, and Quaker faiths of their current privileged status, and insisting that adherents of those faiths must register in their nuptials with the state as a separate act if they want any legal status for their union. Mr. Rahman's view highlights one of the paradoxes of rigorous secularism. If secularism is understood to mean that the state does not interfere with theological matters, then this can leave a large social space in which religions and subcultures can act according to their own traditions, which may be pretty conservative. The Netherlands has, on the face of things, an approach that is quite secularist, but also addresses the problems identified by Ms. Khan that occur when civil and religious nuptials drift apart. Dutch law says that a religious wedding cannot take place unless a civil union has also been contracted. But the country still has the problem of, quote, marital captivity, in other words, the dire situation of women whose husbands will not give them a religious divorce. Catalina Buitenweg, a prominent Green member of the Dutch Parliament, is lobbying the government for a change in civil law that would make it easier and more routine for judges to compel reluctant husbands to release their wives from the religious bonds of a dead marriage. Thanks to the effort of Shirin Musa, a campaigner, keeping a woman in such marital captivity is notionally a criminal offense under Dutch law. But that provision is so draconian that it will hardly be used in practice. A few civil law cases, including Miss Musa's own personal case, have been pursued successfully against reluctant husbands. But if Miss Butenway gets her way, civil law cases will become much easier. But here's the paradox. By the lights of strict secularism, using civil law to bring about religious divorce is problematic. Since religious marriages do not exist in the eyes of a rigorously secular state, it makes no difference to the state whether or not they are terminated. But by the lights of common decency, some would say, a woman caught inside a traditional subculture who wants to restart her life does need help and should get it. And back to the Religion News Service of December 15th. An Australian probe into child abuse attacks Catholic celibacy. An Australian inquiry into child abuse recommended Friday that the Catholic Church lift its demand of celibacy from clergy and that priests be prosecuted for failing to report evidence of pedophilia heard in the confessional. Australia's Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse delivered its final 17-volume report and 189 recommendations following a wide-ranging investigation. Australia's longest-running Royal Commission, which is the country's highest form of inquiry, has been investigating since 2012 how the Catholic Church and other institutions responded to sexual abuse of children in Australia over 90 years. The report heard the testimonies of more than 8,000 survivors of child sex abuse. Of those who were abused, 62% were Catholics. We've concluded that there are catastrophic failures of leadership of Catholic Church authorities over many decades. Recommendations include the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference request that the Vatican consider introducing voluntary celibacy for clergy. It said that the bishop's body should also request clarity on whether information received in the confessional that a child has been sexually abused is covered by the seal of secrecy, or whether absolution of a perpetrator should be withdrawn until the perpetrator confesses to police. Catholic clerics who testified to the Royal Commission gave varying opinions about what, if anything, a priest could divulge about what is said in a confessional about child abuse. The Commission's recommendations, with which interim reports total 409, include making failure to report child sexual abuse a criminal offense, and clerics would not be exempt from being charged. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Thanks very much for listening. The content of this program is, of course, intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Thanks again.